ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The attorney who had a relationship with Fulton County, Georgia DA Fonnie Willis stepped down from his role following a judge's ruling Friday. ABC's Stephen Portnoy has the latest.
The resignation was a response to an ultimatum from Judge Scott McAfee, who said the DA and her team member appear to have testified untruthfully about the timing of their relationship. If Nathan Wade were kept on the case, Judge McAfee said Fonnie Willis would be disqualified. McAfee determined that dismissing the charges against Donald Trump and his co-defendants would not have been the appropriate remedy. Defense attorneys in the case say they respectfully disagree.
Trump's hush money trial in New York's been delayed until at least mid-April in order to allow for the review of more evidence. New York, one of the many cities around the country this weekend holding a St. Patrick's Day parade, and spring break hotspots in Florida. Authorities trying to maintain order at 12 a.m. curfews in effect in Miami Beach. This is ABC News. An independent commission looking into a mass shooting in rural Maine late last year released its initial interim report.
The commission found there were several missed opportunities to take action that could have prevented lives from being lost. Army reservist Robert Card had displayed a well-documented series of mental health concerns prior to October 25th when he opened fire at a bar and bowling alley in Lewiston, Maine, killing 18 people and injuring 13 more. Police said the commission did not follow up on behavior concerns and had sufficient probable cause to take Card into custody under Maine's yellow flag law and remove his guns. Dave Packer, ABC News.
One of the three teenagers charged with starting a house fire in Denver that killed five people in 2020 was sentenced to 40 years in prison. Gavin Seymour had pleaded guilty to one count of second-degree murder. Five members of a Senegalese family were killed in the fire that was set apparently out of revenge for a stolen cell phone that was mistakenly traced to that home. Brian Clark, ABC News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote, because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Being blind doesn't always look how others may think.
Retinitis pigmentosa aimed to overwhelm my family.
It tried to cut me down.
I know where to find support and where I can be seen.
Innovative research, educational resources, supportive community.
The Foundation Fighting Blindness is leading the charge in finding treatments and cures for blinding diseases. Learn more at fightingblindness.org. A public service message from the Foundation Fighting Blindness.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. There's concern artificial intelligence could cause problems for the 2024 elections. Alex Gonzalez reports.
Shauna Broussard is a commissioner with the Federal Election Commission and contends disclosure efforts are an effective way to inform voters, but not infringe on First Amendment rights.
There's a big controversy that deals with First Amendment rights when you're dealing with speech, and particularly when dealing with political speech. But one thing that the courts have said that when it comes to disclosure, disclaimers are still okay.
Broussard says while a number of states have passed AI-related legislation, it should be regulated at the federal level. Digital watermarking and other alternatives have also been suggested, which Broussard says is a step in the right direction, but not sufficient to solve the problems AI is causing. Daryl West is a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. He says while AI has presented unique and new challenges and does support legislation, he argues holding bad actors accountable with existing laws could be part of the solution.
We need to enforce them. We need to start prosecuting the worst offenders.
The Brookings Institution has also published a list of best practices for state election officials to follow, which include facilitating dialogue with voters and the public around potential challenges of AI, training election staff to use AI tools appropriately, as well as testing for and mitigating potential AI dangers before launching AI tools and services. I'm Alex Gonzalez. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bowden.
Monday on Matt Nair On Air, political consultant Joseph Hickey joins us. Maggie Dawn is here as well, and we go beyond the cheese with mushrooms. Join us.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Some flurries or light snow showers today, otherwise cloudy skies and breezy with a high around 36. Winds out of the northwest, 20 to 30 miles per hour. For tonight, slight chance of snow, low of 17. For Sunday, slight chance of snow, still breezy. We'll see a high near 27.
It's 39 at our studios.
Rice Lake's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
News desserts of the week. Here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Jim Santel, and this is Morning Cannolis. It is our weekly review, our analysis, our examination, our talking with you about these major stories in our lives, statewide, nationally, and sometimes throughout the world, every single Saturday morning here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking about those areas of government, law, and the aspiration for justice in America and worldwide that animate our lives. Thank you so much for being with me this morning for this hour and hopefully the second hour too on our Saturday morning broadcast. It is Saturday, March 16th, 2024. This is our 89th broadcast on these Civic Media stations statewide and in other places throughout our country as well. We'll be talking about that at the end of the second hour. We've got a very special programming note coming up about the future of this broadcast. We're not going away. We're going to be restyling and recrafting somewhat to ensure that our goals, that is in the areas of government law and aspiration of justice, are further met and further advanced as a result of our discussions here every Saturday morning. As always, we are encouraging this morning your questions, your inquiries about the subject matters on our syllabus for this day. That number is always is 844-967-2789. Once again, that's 844-967-2789. My excellent producer, Johnny, and I are here in the studios of WAUK in Waukesha to take those calls, those inquiries of yours, and to get you on the air talking with me about those significant things in our lives. As always, this morning we have an ambitious, very ambitious, but nonetheless achievable agenda. I'm going to talk with you in just a moment or so about what that syllabus is all about. We ask three simple questions. What happened? Why are those things relevant? And what options do we have in response to them? What is on our agenda for this morning? Lots of things happening in the areas of government and rule of law and justice just in the past 24 hours, 48 hours, certainly throughout this past week. It has been a big news week when it comes to these important issues of government operation and law in America. We're going to be doing some geography, going right down the East Coast in this, our first hour, and probably a bit into our second hour as well. We're going to talk about cases in New York, then also in Georgia, and then also in Florida. And you know what those are. You know about the status of the state case, the so-called hush money case, pending right now in a Manhattan criminal courtroom. I'm going to talk about what happened just yesterday and why it's going to certainly prompt a change in the scheduling of the trial in that matter. I'm going to go south into Georgia. Two major events on Thursday and Friday of just this past week, one of them involving some of the dismissal of charges in that omnibus RICO indictment against Donald Trump and others. And then almost as significant, the decision by the judge there not to disqualify the prosecutor, but to require that her deputy, the fellow who is principally in charge of prosecuting the case, that he no longer be a part of that. We're going to talk about what the judge said. We're going to do some microscopic justice once again, going deep into the specifics of what the judge in that case said and did, the reasons for his decision. And in all three of these areas, including the Mar-a-Lago case, we'll be doing some analysis about where these cases come from, what the decisions mean, and what we can anticipate for the future. Again, in New York and in Georgia and in Florida, all those cases, three of the four major criminal cases pending against the former president, a present candidate for the presidency. His name, of course, is Donald Trump. And then into our second hour, we're going to go back to, as we often do, the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, which issued two, although related, decisions yesterday in the area of social media. We have talked about this a lot in the past, that one of the major focuses of our United States Supreme Court in this 2023-2024 term has been on social media and the interaction between it and you and government. Two major cases, basically the same opinion authored by Amy Coney Barrett, released just yesterday, having to do with this connection between government officials and the media, social media in particular, things that are out there posted on social media. We'll talk about that. And then, as I said, at the end of the second hour, a significant programming note about what you're going to be hearing going forward on our 90th broadcast beginning next Saturday. We'll tell you more about that at the end of our second hour this morning on our broadcast. Thank you once again for joining Johnny and me for our discussion, and let us launch right into that ambitious agenda this morning by beginning in Manhattan. Big news coming out just yesterday, March 15th, a New York judge, his name is Juan Merchant, who is presiding over the so-called catch and kill or hush money case. This is the case involving criminal charges against Donald Trump, alleging that right before the 2016 election, he basically violated New York law in failing to properly account for, describe transactions, financial transactions operated through his fixer, Michael Cohen, by which he paid off a porn star named Stormy Daniels and caught that case, killed it through the National Enquirer, a fellow named David Pecker, and prevented us, at least for that time, from hearing all about that. The allegation is less about the salacious nature of that relationship, but rather a violation of New York state law. And as we said last week, when we talked a lot about the categories of things that Alvin Bragg, who is the district attorney there, he's the prosecutor in that case, the things he's going to be presenting, yes, he's going to talk about that financial transaction, but he's also going to talk about the setting in which it happens and describe these other things that also happened with a second woman also being paid off, a doorman being paid off, the Access Hollywood tape, all those kinds of things that were happening at the same time, telling this overall story, what I have described as Donald Trump's origin story when it comes to attempts to undermine, to affect the election in America. He is going to describe the fact that this case, like the others, most of the others, is at least at a minimum, also about election interference. Why? Because the allegations go to that fundamental theme that Alvin Bragg is going to be presenting during the course of the trial, that Donald Trump, by doing this, by paying people off, by violating thereby New York law, he effectively prevented us from understanding fully what he is as a candidate, and therefore attempted to interfere with the election, the campaign at that time. What happened? What happened just yesterday? Well, in order to understand what happened yesterday in the context of that prosecution, we need to go back and understand that the judge, Juan Merchant, who is the trial judge who's presiding over this proceeding in his courtroom, has scheduled this case to go ahead. Jury selection beginning on March 25th. That's right. That's 9 days from today, the end of this month. Judge Merchant had indicated that he is going to begin jury selection on that day, a date that's been on his calendar for a long time. And now with all of the other trials, as we've talked about previously, all of them highly unlikely going to be going ahead at any time in the near future. Doubtful they will even see the light of day in this calendar year. Juan Merchant said, let's go ahead and try this case. And indeed, Alvin Bragg said, yes, ready to go. And the plan was to do just that until until maybe not full stop, but a considerable stop happened just yesterday. Again, we need to go back to understand how it is that this happened. During the course of any criminal case, including in the state of New York, in this Manhattan courtroom, there is a statutory, a legal, a constitutional obligation for prosecutors to present to the defense all of the information that has been gathered during the course of the investigation to ensure that the defendant has a full and complete opportunity to review all the things the government is going to be presenting during the course of the trial. That includes witness statements. That includes reports of interviews. That includes forensics evidence, photographs, other things that might be used during the course of the prosecution, even things that may not see the light of day. All of that is required in the federal system. We've got statutory authority for that. There are cases called Jenks and Brady that also impose upon federal prosecutors the obligation, the rightful, the constitutional obligation to produce information, to produce that information so that a defendant, in this case, Donald Trump, can properly defend himself against the charges brought against him. That is a fundamental concept. It is what animates our system. It's what I lived by and embraced for 30 years of my practice doing criminal work in the federal district court in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. It makes sense, and it is a part of our fundamental system of the rule of law. And so what happens here? As a result of the prosecution, the announcement of the charges, which I just described involving this hush money case brought by the district attorney promptly turns over all the information that he and his staff, investigators, have gathered about this particular charge, supporting and also arguably exculpating the defendant for conduct in which he is allegedly involved. That's a part of the process. And as a part of that, in June of last year, Alvin Bragg reached out where? To the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. Reached down Manhattan, if you will, and reached into a federal room, the room of the U.S. Attorney there, and said, I know that in the past, 2008, you investigated a case involving the same set of facts. And during the course of that, not only did you prosecute and ultimately convict this fellow named Michael Cohen, but you also did other things that pursued these allegations that there was a federal violation based upon the same fundamental facts. And Alvin Bragg appropriately said, I want those materials. I want you to give those to me so that I can produce those to the defendant in my state case. That's proper to do. And that's what he did. And the U.S. Attorney's Office back in the summer of last year produced some, heavy emphasis on some, of those documents. Came back and said, here's what we've got. And Alvin Bragg repeatedly, in that connection, did turn over the documents that were produced to him by the U.S. Attorney's Office, had done that previously, did it again now. And then in January of this year, the defense, on behalf of Donald Trump, served its own subpoena upon the U.S. Attorney's Office for the same kinds of things, presumably. Now, we don't know exactly what those requests and what the subpoena looked like, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about what happened in the wake of the defense subpoena of the U.S. Attorney's Office and how that affected the scheduling of the trial right after this break, discussion following about the status of that criminal case in Manhattan.
Is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
For the longest time, it was hard for me to even get out of the house, much less do a backside 180. It took me a bit to understand what was going on, but eventually I learned I had anxiety. Now I'm getting help for it and feeling so much better. Sure, some days are better than others, but the whole thing about getting out of the house, that's not really an issue anymore.
Mental health care is working. See what it can do for you at mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matinee on Air.
Back talking this morning in these first segments of our first hour on our Saturday morning broadcast, all about the status of this case that was scheduled to go to trial a week from Monday in a Manhattan criminal courtroom, a state criminal courtroom, and the decision by the judge, necessitated by events, to postpone that proceeding. Let's talk more about what prompted that decision by Juan Merchan, the judge who's presiding over that case, right before the break, telling you about the process by which a defendant is constitutionally, statutorily entitled to get documents as a part of the prosecution and the defense of the case. Again, a defendant not required under the law to produce anything to defend himself or herself, itself, under our Constitution, presumed innocent until proven guilty, not obliged to do anything. But yes, indeed, the prosecution not only has the burden of proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury unanimously, but also to produce materials, information, so that the defendant has a complete sense of what is going on in the case, what he or she or it is going to hear during the course of the trial. And again, Alvin Bragg did that in connection with his own investigative materials, made a request to the U.S. Attorney's Office, also there in Madison, in Manhattan, and asked them for all the materials that they had in connection with their own discreet investigation back in 2008 of the same events. And that corpus of material also relevant because, of course, inside that federal investigation was a lot of information about an individual named Michael Cohen, who was ultimately convicted for that and other things in the federal court. And he, of course, is a major witness in this state case now on the state docket of Judge Juan Merchan. And so the information relevant, and Alvin Bragg gets the initial tranche of materials, turns those over to the defendant. And again, in January of just this year, the defense files and submits to the U.S. Attorney's Office what could arguably be called a follow-up and maybe even somewhat duplicative request. We haven't seen the specific language of their subpoena, but they asked for the same set of materials, and lo and behold, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan comes forward and produces about 100,000 pages of records. And that coming out, of course, in the last couple of weeks or so, more materials apparently coming down the road, 100,000 documents, presumably not previously seen by Alvin Bragg, not previously produced through this system, which I previously described right now. And as a result of that, appropriately, the defendant says, wait a minute, we are ready to go to trial in 9 days. I'm just getting now 100,000 documents that I've not previously seen. How can I prepare my defense? And in this particular case, when a defendant comes forward and says, I do not have sufficient time, given the timing of the clock and the movement forward on this trial, Donald Trump's lawyers are right. Donald Trump's lawyers are right to say we need more time to look at all of this information. Now, as a practical matter, do we live in a time when all of these materials are produced in banker's boxes the old way when I first started as a prosecutor to produce them? The answer is no. It's all done electronically. And yes, indeed, there are systems in place for ensuring that defendants and prosecutors and other people involved in the case on both sides can do word searches, can do analysis of documents. It is no longer the case that as a lawyer, as a prosecutor, defense attorney, I need to sit down and go through each one of those banker's boxes in great detail and identify every single document, read every single document But I do want to find out what is there. And so, again, electronics will help me a whole lot in doing that, word searches, those kinds of things. But there may be some documents. And indeed, Alvin Bragg has confirmed that among those 100,000 documents, there is a subset that is fairly relevant to this, focusing again upon Michael Cohen. And certainly, if you're the if you're defense attorneys in these cases responding to what the prosecution has provided to you, you want to read those documents yourself and don't want to rely upon an electronic system just to tell you what they say. It is important as a part of your defense. And so what happens in this particular case? These materials coming in, 73,000 pages of records initially, 31,000 additional documents also dropped as a result of this, some subset of those apparently highly relevant to this case. As a result of this, Donald Trump's lawyers say, "Judge, we can't go ahead in 9 days, 10 days from now. We've got to review all these materials as a part of our defensive preparation to ensure that there is, in fact, a defense to be made. If there are some things in this material, this tranche material that we need to take a look at, we need to prepare for that." And indeed, they're right about that. And what happens, of course, is they file then a motion for an extension, a delay in the trial. They're seeking 90 days, 3 months, which, again, depending upon what those 100,000 documents say, may or may not be unreasonable. Alvin Bragg has come back and said, well, not all of them are relevant. How about 30 days? 30 days is what he's proposing. And, oh, by the way, the Trump attorneys are also saying, "Judge, you need to dismiss this case." Why? Because of these pretrial antics, as they describe them, of the government, the failure of between the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Alvin Bragg DA's office to produce these documents, all of that renders it impossible for us to defend against this case. Also claiming that for that reason, the case should be dismissed outright. Outright dismissal, which could be one of the remedies on Judge Merchan's agenda, although highly, highly likely. What has he done? Well, he has said that I'm going to delay the case right now for 30 days, for 30 days beyond March 25th. And so we know it's not starting on March 25th. What we do know, however, that on that morning, on Monday morning, March 25th, he's going to call everybody in and he is going to say to them, "What is going on here? I had this scheduled. We're all ready to go. And now we're getting additional documents this late in the process. This case has been charged for a year and discovery should have been undertaken and pursued and exchanged long before now. What is going on here?" He has asked them to provide a detailed timeline of the events leading up to this recent disclosure. Tell us what happened exactly during the course of this process. And he has also said that he will set a new trial date if necessary after the hearing. He said he wants his detailed timeline and also sought the correspondence with federal prosecutors who recently turned over these records, including letters and subpoenas and emails and notes and messages. He's trying to get to the bottom of what happened to derail this trial. He is not happy, plainly, and I suspect we're going to be hearing about this from the judge on March 25th. Alvin Bragg has got to be upset about this as well because his federal counterparts, again, federal prosecutors, not state prosecutors, now disclosing weeks, days before the trial, all this information. We don't know if Alvin Bragg had it before, presumably not, or he would have disclosed it. But that is the circumstance that brings us to this situation where the trial long anticipated, the one trial that might have gone ahead this calendar year, now suspended again and likely going to be suspended for at least 30 days, if not longer. Again, my own assessment is that 90 days may not be an inappropriate amount of time, given what has happened here. 100,000 documents, as I said before, probably not all of them relevant, but relevant to a defense, you bet it is. Why? Because a lot of that has to do with Michael Cohen. Who is Michael Cohen? He is going to testify predominantly during the course of this trial about the very transactions that allegedly resulted in this violation of New York law. For that reason, all of this relevant as we now look to March 25th and down the road for the rescheduling of this trial pending in the Manhattan court. When we come back, we're going to go south to Georgia, spend a lot of time talking about other developments of just this past week in the parallel but different criminal investigation going on there.
Sawyer County's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The attorney who had a relationship with Fulton County, Georgia DA Fonnie Willis stepped down from his role following a judge's ruling Friday. ABC's Stephen Portnoy has the latest.
The resignation was a response to an ultimatum from Judge Scott McAfee, who said the DA and her team member appear to have testified untruthfully about the timing of their relationship. If Nathan Wade were kept on the case, Judge McAfee said Fonnie Willis would be disqualified. McAfee determined that dismissing the charges against Donald Trump and his co-defendants would not have been the appropriate remedy. Defense attorneys in the case say they respectfully disagree.
Trump's hush money trial in New York's been delayed until at least mid-April in order to allow for the review of more evidence. New York, one of the many cities around the country this weekend holding a St. Patrick's Day parade and spring break hotspots in Florida. Authorities trying to maintain order at 12 a.m. curfews in effect in Miami Beach. This is ABC News.
Welcome their new defensive player. I'm Mike Clemens with Sports. The Packers brought in Xavier McKinney to Green Bay to sign his contract with the team. At $68 million over 4 years, the former Giants safety will be the fourth highest paid player in his position. McKinney and the Packers' new running back, Josh Jacobs, both played together at Alabama. Did he ever think they'd be teammates again?
Nah, never. I'm glad that we're back on the same team, though. I can tell you that because he's a special back, somebody that really good friends with. You know, he's a great teammate. He's a guy that plays really hard, makes a lot of plays. So it's going to be fun to just be back on the field with him and practicing against him.
Men's college basketball. Marquette beat Providence last night 79-68. They will play UConn tonight in the Big East. The Badgers set to face Purdue in the Big Ten tournament today. They got past Northwestern thanks to some sharp shooting. Stephen Crowell.
So AJ's pulling deep threes, Max. John's been unbelievable. So just getting that lid off the rim early.
That's the Badgers' Stephen Crowell. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Some flurries or light snow showers today, otherwise cloudy skies and breezy with a high around 36. Winds out of the northwest, 20 to 30 miles per hour. For tonight, slight chance of snow, low of 17. For Sunday, slight chance of snow, still breezy. We'll see a high near 27.
It's 39 at our studios.
Most of us can agree we should have the freedom to make our own medical decisions. Politicians should have no role at all, but not California mega millionaire Eric Hovde. Hovde said, "I am totally opposed to abortion and I'm 100% pro-life." And he supported overturning Roe v. Wade, the court case that protected abortion rights. Hovde's been supported by Wisconsin Right to Life, an extreme anti-abortion group that supports banning abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, and threatens doctors and nurses with criminal charges for providing abortion care. With views like that, Hovde could be a crucial vote in favor of a national abortion ban, letting politicians decide what's right for women. Call Eric Hovde at his California office at 714-730-4444. Tell him his position on abortion is dangerous for Wisconsin women. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
Sam Neill talked about being at the Jurassic Park premiere in London with his 10-year-old son and sitting next to Princess Diana. Apparently, Sam Neill's son had really bad gas through the whole premiere. His biggest fear was that Princess Di thought it was him, and he didn't say anything. He did not out his son. I think that's so cool.
That's a great dad right there.
That's a great dad.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. From Birchwood to Poplar, this is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, your home for news, talk, and sports. Hey.
Hey.
morning all about the status of cases involving current presidential candidate Donald Trump, former president of the United States of America. And in our first segments, talking about what happened in Manhattan just this past week as a result of the late disclosure of a tranche of documents, 100,000 documents coming out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. That's the district that previously, under the prior administration, had investigated the same fact scenario that is now the subject of a state prosecution pending there in the Manhattan District Court in front of Judge Juan Merchan. And the takeaway from this is a lot of explaining to do. The district attorney himself, obviously concerned about this, had said, in an abundance of caution, appropriate to have some delay accomplished to ensure the defense has an opportunity to review these materials. The defense, of course, saying, no, we need 90 days, not just 30 days. And indeed, because of the misbehavior, the misconduct, as they allege it, by the prosecution, the failure to produce these documents in a more timely fashion, because of that, the entire case should be dismissed. Now, unlikely that Juan Merchan is going to do that on March 25th, but he is going to ask some piercing questions about exactly what happened, and indeed he should. There is some responsibility here on the side of the DA for getting this material. There's a huge amount of responsibility here. And beyond that, there is some explaining that needs to be done coming out of my own former agency, the U.S. Department of Justice. Why are these materials being produced now for the first time when we've known about the pendency of the prosecution for well over a year? What happened? And inside the Department of Justice, Merrick Garland also has some explaining to do, as does the U.S. attorney there, for why the delay happened. Why is it that just upon a subpoena from the defense, which they can do, why now are these materials being produced for the first time? It is a cause of great concern, not only for the scheduling of the trial, which, again, is going to be pushed back, arguably months. And as I've said before, every time a trial is delayed, other things can happen. And so today, where there is no certainty about exactly when this trial is going to be conducted, when jury selection will begin, all kinds of things can happen between the time of a prosecution initiation and the course of discovery, even the setting of a trial date. Witnesses change, positions changed, counsel changes, all kinds of things, facts and circumstances can develop and be disclosed that will prompt a further delay. We don't know what's happening in the future, but this is an example of the kinds of things that can, in fact, do happen, not without explanation, which is what Judge Merchan is going to ask, but they happen, and they result in delays in the prosecution and the defense of cases like this. We will plainly be very attentive here on all the broadcast stations of Civic Media to this trial and others. Not happening 9 days from now. Let's go south, and let's look to Georgia. We also know there this omnibus, this huge sweeping RICO case, 41 counts, 19 co-defendants initially, huge sweeping indictment returned by an indicting grand jury there, again, a long time ago. Now, like in New York, in the course of pretrial motions, what is that all about? It means that following the return of the indictment, two major things happen. One is the defense has an opportunity to file motions with the judge, as does the prosecution, for ask for various things in connection with the anticipated trial, motions to suppress, motions to keep evidence out, motions to bring evidence in, all sorts of things related to the validity of the indictment itself, the charges, all sorts of things related to witnesses and forensics evidence, and all kinds of things can happen. All of that written out for the judge, often oral argument in front of judges in this pretrial period to narrow and sift and ensure that when the trial begins, it is focused upon things that are relevant and material. That's what the process is all about in every single one of these cases, including the Manhattan case, and certainly including the omnibus Georgia case brought by Fonnie Willis, who again is the Fulton County District Attorney, returned by a grand jury, an investigative grand jury, and then indicting grand jury, this sweeping RICO charge against Donald Trump and many others. And so what has happened recently? Well, we're going to talk at great length this morning a microscopic justice analysis of what the judge did with respect to this continuing and pending until just yesterday challenge to Fannie Willis's continued role as the prosecutor. We're going to get to that in just a moment or so. Even before Scott McAfee, who is the judge in that case, he is the state court judge who is presiding over that criminal case in Fulton County. Even before that, the day before, the judge quashes six charges in that omnibus indictment. Surprising that he did this, but perhaps understandable as you look once again at the decision, the written decision that he issued. Issues this decision to dismiss, Scott McAfee does, six of the 41 counts against the 19 co-defendants. Four of them already have pled guilty, as we have talked before, since this grand jury indictment was returned in August. The charge, the fundamental RICO charge remains. That's a racketeering charge brought against all the defendants. And the judge is very clear in his order that those charged based upon overt acts in furtherance of this RICO criminal engagement, that the indictment says the defendants engaged in furtherance of this racketeering conspiracy, the RICO allegations and the overt acts described in the indictment, all of those remain. None of that affected by his decision on Thursday to dismiss six other counts. The judge, Scott McAfee, explicit in stating that his order does not apply to those acts, nor does it relate to this qualification issue, which we're going to get to. The nine-page ruling that Judge McAfee does issue in the middle of this week, however, takes aim at charges asserting this, that Donald Trump and other defendants solicited public officials to break the law by violating their oaths of office. That was what's set forth in the indictment. That's the theory upon which these particular counts proceeded. For example, one of those counts against Donald Trump said that he unlawfully solicited, requested, and importuned the Georgia Secretary of State, you know his name well, it's Brad Raffensperger, to violate his oath of office by decertifying the election. That's what one of those counts said. And the judge comes back and says, as to that count and others, which we'll describe in particularity in just a moment, he says these six counts contain all the essential elements of the crime, but fail to allege in sufficient detail regarding the nature of their commission, the kinds of things the defendant is entitled to know about, again, as a part of our process. Due process, you're entitled to discovery, the information the government has is going to present against you during the course of the trial, and you're also entitled to know with detail the specific allegations against you in the indictment. The judge, Judge McAfee, writes this. He said these counts, do not give the defendants enough information to prepare their defenses intelligently, as the defendants could have violated the Constitution and thus the statute in dozens, if not hundreds, of distinct ways. That's the judge writing in his nine-page opinion of just this past week. One of those six charges, once again, count 28, related to Trump's telephone call. You recognize that already from the description that I read from the indictment. Raffensperger is called by then still President Trump on January 2nd, pressuring the Secretary of State to find enough votes to overturn the presidential election results in that state. Another charge, count 38, also now dismissed from this indictment, relates to a letter that Trump sent to Raffensperger in September of 2021, asking him to decertify the Georgia presidential election results or seek similar legal remedies and announce the true winner. That's the basis of count 38. Other counts quashed by the judge also related to these attempts to pressure public officials. Three counts, those are numbered 2 and 6 and 23 in the indictment, alleged that several of these defendants broke the law when they urged Georgia lawmakers to appoint pro-Trump electors after Joe Biden, our current president, actually won the state. Count 5 concerned a call that Trump made to a fellow named David Ralston, R-A-L-S-T-O-N, who was then the Speaker of the Georgia House of Representatives. During that conversation, according to the allegations in the indictment, this count now dismissed, Trump pressed Mr. Ralston to call a special legislative session to appoint new electors. Again, all a part of this theory that's based upon that the defendants soliciting public officials to violate their oath. The judge saying, yeah, you've got the count described and you've got the elements there, but you're not giving specific, sufficient, detailed information upon which the defendant can rely in defending against the case as we go to trial. And so he dismisses those six counts. Now, as I said before, does it accomplish a huge blow? Well, the answer is probably not. Probably not. But it certainly does take away some of the force of this omnibus 41-count indictment. And that leads to the remedies that may be out there. Fannie Willis has three choices. Fannie Willis has three choices here. She can do nothing. She can simply let that stand and not appeal this at all and go to trial without those six counts. Arguably, she's going to tell the same kind of story as those counts described in sort of the speaking indictment, the speaking charges already in those six counts, no longer a part of the prosecution against Donald Trump and the others. She can do nothing and simply go ahead with the case as it has been reduced by Scott McAfee, or she can appeal. She can pursue this to an appellate court and say, you know what, the judge was wrong. And in fact, the counts do, in fact, provide enough information for the defendant to know what it is that he and the others are charged with and seek to overturn Scott McAfee's opinion. Or third, and probably the most likely, she can go back to the grand jury. She can go back to the grand jury and say, well, it appears that the judge did not like the language of the indictment as it was returned by the grand jury. We're going to restyle these counts. We're going to add that detail that was not in the first indictment. We're going to ask the grand jury to re-indict on these cases, called a superseding indictment, a follow-up indictment that corrects the problems that the district court judge, the trial judge, identified in his order. That's also a remedy that she has out there, probably one of those that she is considering at the top of her list right now. At some point soon, she will need to identify which one of those three remedies she is going to pursue. Now, that also underscores, again, the grand jury process and how this works. As I've often said on this broadcast, grand juries do, in fact, review the evidence, the testimony, the documents, all the other evidence before them to determine whether there's probable cause. And yes, it is in the end a decision by the grand jury to issue charges. But as a practical matter, as we have also discussed, it is the obligation of the prosecutor, in this case, Fannie Willis, when I was a prosecutor for 30 years as an assistant U.S. attorney with the imprimatur of the U.S. attorney, to draft what it is the grand jury has found, or is finding during the course of their investigation, and present the draft of that to the grand jury to embrace or reject. As I said before, there have been times in my career when a grand jury has gotten back to me and said, you know what, we do not concur, Mr. Santel. We're not going to go ahead with these particular counts. That's their role, but it is the role of the prosecutor. And this is the key here. In this case, Fannie Willis to come forward and say, we've got to remedy the problem with these six counts. And so, grand jury, we're not asking you to make a different determination on probable cause, but we are going to present to you some new language as to these six counts, asking you to supersede, to find probable cause as these offense conduct pieces are now redescribed in the corrective or superseding grand jury. She can do that. Can go back to the grand jury. That's probably what she will do, especially since, unlike the Manhattan case that we described earlier in this broadcast, there is no trial date right now. I know she has talked about wanting to go ahead in August, and the defense plainly has poo-pooed that notion, said, no, this has got to be tried well into 2025. But she's got the opportunity now to go back and remedy that problem. And it's highly likely, again, she'll go back to the grand jury and do just that. But it is undeniably a reflection of the crafting, the drafting that was done on behalf of the grand jury the first time around in this very extensive grand jury indictment. And now Fannie Willis, if she wants to pursue this, needs to go back and correct the errors that her office did on behalf of the grand jury in drafting that initial omnibus indictment the first time around. We'll see what she does, and we'll see what she does when it comes to the future prosecution of this case. We know as well, the other major story coming out just yesterday, that Fannie Willis remains on this case. And when we come back, we're going to go deep into the decision also by Scott McAfee to keep her on that case in exchange for the principal, the lead prosecutor, his name is Nathan Wade, to resign from that prosecution. All that happened yesterday. We're going to talk about it next.
Listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. The Todd Alba Show.
I love me some Drew Holiday. My favorite Buck. I love what he's doing. I just really, really wish it wasn't for the Boston Celtics. My loyalty is still more to Giannis. But like when Drew scores a bucket still, I'm like, yeah.
That's, like to a former true. Lover.
I got a Drew Holiday jersey, a Bucks jersey, and I got an Aaron Jones Packers jersey. This is so why... I'm a scoring former lover for both of those players.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
Talking now in this, the final segment of our first hour, getting into depth on the other significant thing that came out of Fulton County just yesterday. This decision, again, by Scott McAfee. Yes, he's the same judge who dismissed those six counts from the indictment, leaving Fannie Willis with some decision-making to do about what she does next with respect to those counts. The other major thing that Scott McAfee did yesterday is release his omnibus order. We're going to spend some time going through it. A 23-page order finding that there is not a basis for Fannie Willis or her office to be disqualified from the future prosecution of this case, thus enabling her to make decisions not only about those six counts, but other things in the future prosecution, the pretrial motions still pending there. But in exchange for that, finding that the principal prosecutor, Special Assistant District Attorney Nathan Wade, hired by Fannie Willis during the course of this proceeding and with whom she had a personal romantic relationship, that he needs to go. And indeed, in the wake of the judge's order of just yesterday, Nathan Wade, the other big news, resigned from that Trump case after the judge's ruling, finding, again, no basis upon which to disqualify the officer, Fannie Willis, but finding an appearance of impropriety. And we're going to get to that, the basis for the decision by Nathan Wade to leave and no longer being part of this, ensuring, if you will, that Fannie Willis, at least for now, has the capacity to go ahead and prosecute the case, but without him. And so what is the basis for this? Again, we're going to spend some time at the last minutes of this segment, and then going into our second hour, some deep dive, some microscopic justice analysis of exactly what it is the judge said and what he didn't say about this all-encompassing decision. This challenge is brought by a defendant named Michael Roman, R-O-M-A-N. He's one of the defendants in this case. He's joined by eight other co-defendants who also joined in this motion to disqualify the Fulton County DA's office and the DA in particular, on various grounds, and specifically alleging that DA and Wade traveled together on multiple occasions and had other relationships, associated as expenses during the course of their not only relationship, but also the time that they were prosecuting this case together. The claims presented, as the judge said, a possible financial conflict of interest for the district attorney. And in the end, as you're going to see as we go through this analysis, he finds that there is not actually, as we have said on this broadcast and others, there actually is not a conflict of interest presented by the defense. The defense motion presented by Roman and the other defendants in this case, what he does say in a second major portion of his order is that there is indeed an appearance of impropriety that necessitates that something be done here. And I would offer the perspective on this, which is that the judge is effectively cleaning up the personnel matters, the admittedly embarrassing, the admittedly probably inappropriate and improper inside the office relationship that should never have gone forward. We'll talk about some of the language that he uses to describe that relationship. What he doesn't say appropriately is that that relationship inside the office, as difficult and challenging as it was and problematic as it is, does not affect the prosecution outside of the office with respect to Donald Trump, doesn't deprive them of any constitutional or statutory rights. And for that reason, no conflict of interest, nothing to support the disqualification of the prosecutor herself, if indeed this principal who prosecutes on her behalf, on behalf of the office, Nathan Wade, if he is no longer a part of this. Fascinating opinion, which we're going to get into as we do just that. A lot of preliminary information set forth again by the judge in his omnibus order, which is readable. It is digestible. I encourage you to take a look at it if you haven't done already just that. He describes the 2.5 days of testimony. Many, if not all of you, remember that well, including testimony of various individuals, including Nathan Wade, including, stunningly, the DA herself takes the stand and describes things related to the relationship and her own conduct. And the court, as it says, on this very second page, after having given all the parties exactly what the judge promised, a full opportunity to disclose what they want to disclose, a full opportunity, evidentiary-wise, to argue the case as well, the court finds that the defendants failed, that is a defense, this Mr. Roman and others, failed to meet their burden of proving that the DA acquired an actual conflict of interest, in this case, through her personal relationship and recurring travels with her lead prosecutor, Nathan Wade, the financial issues there as well. All the other grounds for disqualification, including forensic misconduct, which we'll also get to, are also denied. He said there's simply no basis for doing any of this. And then goes on to say this on page 2. The established record now highlights, however, a significant appearance of impropriety, distinguishes that from the legal standard of actual conflict of interest, even forensic misconduct, which he also describes troublingly later in the opinion. He says that the significant appearance of impropriety infects the current structure of the prosecution team. Exactly what I'm describing before, this internal issue, the internal structure, the structure of the prosecution team, an appearance that must be removed through the state's selection of one of two options, either to get rid of Mr. Wade, he's got to go, or Fonnie Willis and the DA's office have got to be disqualified. The defense motions, he said, are therefore granted in part, and then proceeds to describe the conflict of interest law in the state of Georgia. And in particular, says that highest courts consistently remind us that prosecutors are indeed held to a unique and exacting professional standard in light of their public responsibility and their power. Got it just right. Prosecutors have this tremendous amount of authority and power and need to wield it on behalf of the people they represent with integrity, with a focus on justice, the rule of law. That's what really animates Alvin Bragg in that Manhattan case to say, you know what? I've got a responsibility to ensure that justice is done here. And yes, indeed, Donald Trump in that case is entitled to some additional time to review this document tranche that's just recently released. And again, the judge here, Scott McAfee, in this unrelated, arguably related around the edges case, says, reminds prosecutors of this high burden that they have when it comes to dealing with and prosecuting cases. And then goes on to say, provides the framework for his decision. He said, the Georgia law says there are two bases upon which to disqualify. Those are conflicts of interest and forensic misconduct. Those are the two generally recognized grounds for disqualification. He cites the law and the authority for that. And that gives rise to the cases that he describes and his resolution, ultimately, of his situation, of this situation, establishing no disqualification, but an awful lot of criticism of the DA there in Fulton County. Right after the top of the hour break, we're going to get into that in greater detail, reciting what the judge said and giving you some opinions, some perspectives on what's going on in Georgia right after this break.
Your hometown station for news, talk, and sports. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Monday on Nightlight, I'm live in Madison and joined in studio by musician James Runday. It's Nightlight from 7 to 9 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.